This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
And I am, for example, Frank Garcia Jr. Here's my ID. You've pulled me over on a routine stop. You've asked for my ID. I can show it to you. You can educate me on the law that I made a mistake on and on the road and issue me the ticket. And we move on and end the day.
But Mr. Garcia considers it a success, not only for these drivers, but for the entire state.
And you're looking at now a House Senate that was close to 80% support and a House and then a House vote that was probably around 65 to 70% voting in favor of this bill.
But restarting the privileges wasn't as easy as stopping them back in 2007. When Governor Kulongowski rescinded these licenses, he did it with an executive order. Why did it take the legislature to vote it in? Why couldn't the governor just issue another executive order?
Good question. After that, in the following legislature, the legislature voted to reinforce that executive order and basically codify it and make it administrative law.
And the Oregon ACLU's Tracy Strauss also has praise for the Oregon legislature.
We think that this is a common sense solution to really what was a public safety problem. A few years ago, the Oregon legislature made it unlawful for people who could not show immigration status to access a driver's license. And this bill really returns us to a rational solution, which is that driver's licenses are based on road safety and your ability to drive, not on your ability to show immigration papers.
The story from the AP said that folks who are looking to get an Oregon driver's license, one of these new driver's licenses for undocumented immigrants, they have to have lived in Oregon for at least a year and meet other requirements. Do you know what the other requirements are?
I imagine that what they're referring to are all the other requirements that people are subject to when they get a driver's license here in Oregon, which means that they need to pass a road safety test and demonstrate that they will be safe on the road, which, again, is really what driver licenses are all about.
For those who were opposed to the licenses because they say that it rewards people who are in the country illegally, do you know if the state has any kind of add-on requirement that says, you know, you have to be in line for, you know, naturalized citizenship after a certain period of time or anything like that?
I don't believe that such a provision was part of the package. And really that whole argument is just, there is no basis of reality in that type of argument. I mean, the licenses are designed to ensure that people are safe on our roads. And it really is just wrong to be jeopardizing public safety just to express frustration with what we all know is a broken federal immigration system. But the Oregon legislature today, they took a step. It really should be a model for other states. They demonstrated what states can do while we're in this position of a broken immigration system at the federal level. There are things like providing access to driver's licenses or what they did early in their session, which is tuition equity, providing access to higher education for Oregonians who have grown up here and been a part of their communities for much of their lives. These are things that states can do while Congress works out immigration to make our immigrant communities feel more welcome.
I'm Don Merrill, KBOO News. The Oregon House of Representatives approved two bills on Monday that target environmental activists working to save old-growth forests in Oregon. The two bills will increase penalties against protesters who interfere with logging activities in Oregon state forests. House Bill 2596 will allow private contractors to sue environmental groups for the cost of damaged equipment. And House Bill 2595 creates a new crime called interference with state forest land management. The bills are in response to the successful campaign waged by environmentalists in the Elliott State Forest to prevent the logging of old-growth trees. Environmental activists with Cascadia Forest Defenders and Cascadia Earth First have staged protests in Elliott State Forest in recent years and at the Oregon State Capitol last May and June, which led to arrests. Representative Wayne Krieger sponsored both bills, saying they would allow district attorneys to, quote, charge these terrorists with a crime and make them accountable, unquote. American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon believes these laws will infringe upon free speech rights. Becky Strauss, legislative director of the ACLU of Oregon, says the laws are too restrictive.
The bill that the ACLU took a position on, which is House Bill 2595, which did pass the House yesterday, we are opposed to the bill because what it does is it's creating this heightened criminal penalty for people who are exercising their right of protest, that it's effectively felonizing civil disobedience. And we're very concerned that the legislature has taken this approach simply because of the content of the protester's speech, and that's very problematic for civil liberties. The chief sponsor of the bill, Representative Wayne Krieger, is from Gold Beach, and I know that he has some relationships with, certainly has had conversations with logging industry. I'm not sure whether that prompted the bill or not. I know this has been a priority of his for a long time.
That was Becky Strauss with the ACLU of Oregon. Unlike other forms of terrorism, environmental activists have never killed or harmed anyone. The bills now move to the Oregon State Senate for approval.
Portland Mayor Charlie Hales outlined his proposed city budget this morning with an estimated $21 million in cuts. 182 jobs would be cut, including 55 from the police department. The Hales budget would also cut the horse-mounted police program for a savings of $1 million and the Office of Healthy Working Rivers, which will save nearly $800,000. TriMet youth passes will be partially restored with a one-time budget cost of $300,000. The budget also includes some revenue increases, mainly through higher water and sewer rates. Expected reforms of the Public Employee Retirement System, or PERS, at the state level are expected to save the city another $1 million. Mayor Hales pointed out that cutting $21 million from a city budget is never easy, but argued that it is necessary for the City of Portland's financial stability.
The City of Portland is set to pay out the largest settlement in its history for the shooting of 20-year-old William Monroe 2 years ago by Portland police. Monroe was shot multiple times by Officer Dane Reister, who claimed that he mistakenly fired live rounds instead of bean bags. The victim was severely wounded by the shootings and will likely suffer from a permanent disability. The city's lawyers proposed to pay Monroe $2.3 million in damages for medical costs and lost wages in response to charges of negligence, assault, and a violation of Monroe's civil rights. The 20-year-old was suffering from mental illness and had been pulling flowers from a garbage can near the Portland waterfront when a passerby called the police. Officer Dane Reister responded to the call, and Monroe initially complied with the officer's commands, emptying his pockets and putting his hands behind his head. But when he was ordered to get down on the ground, he questioned Reister, who pulled out a rifle and fired five rounds. Reister had previously been disciplined for mistakenly shooting another officer during a training exercise. The police bureau has no plans to fire Officer Reister. Critics have pointed out that the city cannot afford to continue to pay out multi-million-dollar settlements for police misconduct, especially as Portland engages in across-the-board budget cuts. The city council must approve the settlement before it goes into effect.
There have been three officer-involved shootings in Central Oregon over the past week. The first occurred last Tuesday in Salem when a couple fleeing a traffic stop pulled into a residential driveway and confronted Sheriff's Deputy Cliff Self, who shot the man, 38-year-old Dusty Keaton Epps. Epps has been treated at Salem Hospital, and Oregon State Police won't say if he was armed or describe the confrontation. On Friday, also in Marion County, Deputy Dale Hewitt shot 48-year-old Michael Kent Wiley. Wiley was found asleep at the wheel of a stolen car near Salem and was shot by the deputy when he allegedly pulled out a gun. Wiley appeared in court Monday to face charges of being a felon in possession of a firearm. Also on Friday, a burglary suspect fled from a crime scene in Madras into the woods north of the city. A plane was used in the search. When the suspect left his vehicle, he was shot by Sergeant Mike Turner of the Oregon State Police. He was hit at least once and is in serious condition. Sergeant Turner is on paid administrative leave during the investigation. The Oregon State Police are not releasing many details of the chase, including whether the suspect was armed or not.
The international shoe company, Nike, headquartered in Washington County, has always had a close relationship with local public officials. But new documents uncovered by the Beaverton Leader newspaper show that the relationship may cross the line of what is legally permissible. County officials were emailed draft documents, which they apparently edited and may have even written for Nike officials. What incentives the company was offered to expand in Washington County is unknown, since the company required county employees to sign non-disclosure agreements. At public meetings, county officials knew well in advance what the company's representatives were going to say and may have even written their testimony for them. If so, the county could be in violation of state law, but no investigation is currently planned.
17 health insurance companies filed new rate proposals on over two dozen different policies yesterday with the Oregon Insurance Division. Health insurance carriers are getting ready for new state and federal health reform requirements. While final rate amounts must still be approved, the increases that have been proposed may shock some consumers. For more, KBOO's Bill Riley spoke with a representative of the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group.
We're speaking with Jesse O'Brien from Oregon Osberg. Can you tell our listeners what these companies are doing and why they're doing it now?
Today is the deadline for health insurance companies in Oregon to file their rate requests with state regulators for plans that will be available through Oregon's Health Insurance Exchange. The state regulators, through what's called the rate review process, will review the insurer's requests, and then they basically have the power to determine whether they think the rates are reasonable given the level of benefits or not, and they can either approve or disapprove or cut back the increase or cut back the rate. So the insurance regulators in Oregon are about to go through an extremely busy period.
Well, do these rates, new rate structures, apply to all health insurance policies or just certain types?
Well, they apply to people who buy coverage for themselves or for their families on their own, that is, not through an employer, or for small business plans. So if you get your coverage through a large employer or through Medicare or Medicaid, this will not apply to you.
So when do you think these decisions are actually going to be made? And is it going to be public? Are we going to know about this? Or?
Yes, well, the way Oregon's rate review process works is that once the rates are filed, they will get posted on a public website run by Oregon's insurance regulators. The website is OregonHealthRates.org. It's pretty user-friendly. Your listeners should definitely check it out. And then they go through a 30-day public comment period. So people who are thinking of buying them or people who have those plans currently can weigh in about how reasonable they think the rates are and what kind of effect the rates would have on them. And then there's usually a public hearing on the rate requests. All of the exchange plans are going to have a public hearing, and that will occur toward the end of the 30-day public comment period. And then the insurance regulators should have a decision on the rates sometime in July, I believe is the plan.
Okay, we're supposed to have a health insurance exchange, which is now called Cover Oregon, right? And then that
right.
we can get on there and we can all compare different health insurance products, kind of apples to apples. So through that and through Oregon health reform, isn't there supposed to be, for consumers, some kind of breaks, offsets, or credits, or something that would lower these rates for most people? Or can you talk about how that would work?
Absolutely. As part of the federal Affordable Care Act, there will be tax credits available for individuals and families and small businesses to help them purchase coverage on the exchange. So the rates that are currently under review are what you might call the sticker price of these plans, but actually a whole lot of folks will be paying much, much less than those rates because they'll be eligible for these credits. And the credits for individuals and families work on a sort of sliding scale, so the lower your income, the more relief you get from the feds. And it's all rather complicated, the way the eligibility for the credit works, but hopefully the exchange will make it pretty seamless for people when they go on.
But isn't one of the mandates of health reform that we will all be required to buy health insurance. You can't not have health insurance after this goes into effect. Isn't that correct?
There is what's called the individual responsibility penalty, and the way this works is that if you do not, if you are not able to show to the IRS that you have essential health coverage, a certain minimum level of health coverage, and you can't show to the IRS that coverage would be unaffordable, then you have to pay a penalty. And the penalty is not especially large, but everyone in that position will have to pay a penalty. I think it is important to point out that if, for whatever reason, coverage is actually unaffordable, there's a formula in the law that enables folks to get out of having to pay that penalty. So there are a lot of ways that you can avoid paying that penalty, but I would certainly recommend that people try to find coverage because there will be a lot of tools to make coverage better and more affordable for folks.
We're speaking with Jesse O'Brien from Oregon Osberg. For KBOO News, this is Bill Riley.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News, stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by KBOO's 45th year anniversary special, Tune In, Turn On, and Remember, at 6. Tonight's Tune In, Turn On episode, Blues and More, hosts Shahid Hamid, and KBOO programmer for over 25 years, talks about his long history with KBOO as a programmer, and George Page is remembered. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's Hard Knock continues the conversation about education with host Davey D. Tomorrow's weather is patchy fog in the morning, but clearing in the afternoon with a high of a beautiful 71 degrees.
It's 5:22, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
After 11 years of war, $664 billion expended so far, 2,210 Americans dead, more than 35,000 of our troops maimed and shattered, and our good reputation spent, what have we built in Afghanistan? According to a top international law enforcement official, you and I have built the world's first true narco state. Congratulations! The opium trade, he added, is a much bigger part of the Afghan economy already than narcotics ever were in Bolivia or Colombia. You might recall that under both George W.'s and Obama's war strategies, eliminating Afghanistan's poppy production was one of America's chief goals, for that crop generated billions of dollars in annual income for the Taliban insurgency, even as it fueled drug addiction here and around the world. So, to combat the drug trade, the U.S. has, 1, destroyed thousands of acres of opium poppies, 2, tried to shift the country's impoverished farmers to wheat and other alternative crops, and 3, paid million-dollar good performers awards to provinces that achieve the coveted poppy-free status. So, mission accomplished? The numbers tell the tale. For the third year in a row, Afghanistan's poppy cultivation has increased. Acreage devoted to poppies this year is expected to set a record. Only one province has reduced its poppy plantings this spring. 12 have increased theirs. Finally, this stat. Afghanistan is expected to produce 90% of the world's opium, plus 75% of the heroin supply. This is Jim Hightower saying, wait, one more telltale stat. An Afghan farmer can get 43 cents a kilogram for wheat, or $203 a kilogram for poppies. Which would you choose? Our war in Afghanistan makes no sense whatsoever. Why are we there?
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
300 workers from various businesses and organizations submitted cards to the Oregon Employment Relations Board on Monday to form a new union for Head Start employees. Oregon union organizers say they're taking a new approach to help workers form unions, and they say it's working. For more about this story, KBOO's Sequoyna Wright, in conjunction with Oregon News Service, tells more.
Unions in Oregon are banding together to help new unions get off the ground, and organizers say the new approach is working. 300 Head Start employees submitted cards to the Employment Relations Board on Monday to form a union, and about 3,000 workers formed unions in the past year. Oregon AFL-CIO President Tom Chamberlain says established unions share advice, manpower, and sometimes even money.
To give workers an opportunity to decide whether they want a union or not takes some real coordination to sort of push back on this multi-billion dollar industry that's grown up around union busting and denying workers the right to organize.
He explains the idea arose after hearing from workers interested in forming a union, but they didn't have time or expertise to do it on their own. Bruce Hansen is the business representative for Amalgamated Transit Union Local 757. He says the new approach of offering support meant 170 new members.
Communicating all the way through the process, updating them, keeping them involved. Yeah, actually, in this one particular location, our local has tried to organize them, I believe, three additional times, unsuccessfully up until this point.
Some of the unions in the new partnership are Oregon AFL-CIO, Communication Workers of America, Oregon Nurses Association, and the Oregon State Building and Construction Trades Council, among others. For KBOO Evening News, in conjunction with Oregon News Service, I'm Sequoyna Wright.
Today, the city of Eugene put in place a ban on plastic bags in the retail market, joining other cities including Corvallis, Portland, San Francisco, Seattle, and Austin, Texas. In addition, retailers in the city will be required to charge 5 cents for a paper bag. The city hopes that residents will begin switching over to reusable bags made of fabric or other materials in order to avoid the paper bag fee. The bag ban will be enforced based on complaints, not active policing. The ban was passed by the Eugene City Council in a 6-2 vote 6 months ago.
The creator of the social media site Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, is facing criticism for his financial support of anti-environmental ads. The ads praise Republican Senator Lindsey Graham for his support of the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline. Zuckerberg placed the ads on his technology political interest group, FWD.us. FWD.us have been outspoken on the passing of comprehensive immigration reform, long-term goals of expanding scientific research, and reforming education. But the tech group is now facing criticism for its support of the Keystone XL pipeline. Credo Action, a social change organization that supports activism and funds progressive nonprofits, has launched a campaign urging Zuckerberg and FWD.us to revoke its ads supporting fossil fuel drilling and the Keystone XL pipeline. A Facebook graphic has already been shared by over 6,000 people, reading, quote, "Hey Zuck, pull your ads supporting Keystone XL." Credo also placed ads on Facebook, but the ads were denied on the basis that they violated Facebook's trademarks. Tomorrow, Credo is joining with 53.org to lead a protest at Facebook headquarters. Tomorrow, activists will deliver a petition signed by over 18,000 people calling on Zuckerberg to stop funding the ads.
George Zimmerman has been charged with second-degree murder in the shooting death of unarmed black teenager Trayvon Martin in February of 2012. Today he waived his right to seek immunity under Florida's controversial Stand Your Ground law in his trial, scheduled for June. The Stand Your Ground law says the person is not required to retreat if they feel they are in imminent danger of being killed or injured. Zimmerman claims that he was attacked by Martin and thus has basis of a Stand Your Ground claim. Legal analysts say that waiving immunity is a strategic choice since it avoids the risk of a judge denying Zimmerman's self-defense claim during a pretrial hearing. The defense could still seek immunity during the trial itself.
At least 40 U.S. military doctors and nurses have been deployed to the Guantanamo prison camp to deal with the ongoing hunger strike of 100 prisoners. The new medical personnel will assist with the force feeding of hunger strikers, despite the fact that force feeding is considered a form of torture under international law. To carry out the process of force feeding, guards strap the prisoners to a chair and force their nostrils up their nose and down their throats. One Guantanamo prisoner recently described it as a razor blade going down his throat. David Reams is an attorney that represents several prisoners at Guantanamo who spoke to The Guardian today.
The military at first denied that there was a hunger strike. The only hunger strikers it acknowledged was the hunger strikers who had been striking before February. Our clients told us that nearly 130 of them were hunger striking. And it's interesting because gradually, week by week and day by day, the Gitmo authorities have been acknowledging higher and higher numbers, to the point where now they are acknowledging that 100 men are on hunger strike. We said about 130, and 20 are being force-fed, including one of my clients that I know about. And it's only gotten worse. It can be extremely painful. One of my clients said that it's like having a razor blade go down through your nose and into your throat. They restrain detainees who don't need to be restrained. That's been happening during the hunger strike because they want to make it as miserable as possible to be on hunger strike. Sometimes they use tubes that are larger than necessary, circumference-wise, which causes extra unnecessary pain. If a detainee resists being taken from his cell to be force-fed, a team of riot squad soldiers, they all look like RoboCops, enter and drag him there. It's really like the way you would treat an animal. That's really it. These men are people. They're real people. They've been held for 12 years without being accused of any crime, separated from their families and homes. Put yourself in their position. They have no end in sight. They're desperate. They don't want to live out the rest of their lives there. There's no reason that they should. And the administration has to do everything in its power, and it has a lot of power to do things, to transfer them away and solve that aspect of the Guantanamo problem.
Guantanamo attorney David Reams, the World Medical Association prohibits its members from participating in force feeding. The United Nations Human Rights Commission has also listed the practice as torture.
Kenneth Bay, a U.S.-based tour operator in North Korea, has been detained in that country since last November. The state-run Korean Central News Agency reported Saturday that Bay is being tried in the country's Supreme Court on charges of plotting to overthrow the North Korean government. The U.S. on Monday called on North Korea to release Bay on humanitarian grounds. Kenneth was born in South Korea and is a naturalized U.S. citizen. He studied psychology at the University of Oregon from 1988 to 1990, but left before finishing his degree. U of O alum Bobby Lee, policy advisor to Governor John Kitzhaber, said he and Kenneth Bay were practically roommates back in college. Lee said he learned about Bay's detainment after running in the Eugene Marathon on Sunday, and he couldn't believe it. Another college friend, Janice Kwan, also met Bay as a freshman. He did so through the Korean Student Association. Both planned to spread the word of Kenneth's detainment. Says Lee, quote, "We want people to care."
More than 2 years after the nuclear catastrophe at Fukushima, Japan, the cleanup at the power plant has become increasingly problematic. In the past month alone, there have been two power outages caused by radioactive wastewater leakages in the underground pools designed to catch the overflow as part of the plant's cooling system. The wastewater has been leaking into the ground at a rate the cleanup crew can't keep up with and has subsequently led to flooding of the cooling system. The rate of leakages has been recorded as high at 75 gallons per minute. The tanks are being used to contain the water, hold as much as 112 Olympic-sized swimming pools, and fill an area of 42 acres. The Tokyo Electric Power Company, better known as TEPCO, has planned to clear-cut a small forest south of the plant in order to make room for hundreds of new tanks. The International Atomic Energy Agency, or the IAEA, warned TEPCO that they are failing in their safety standards and that it should be considered as long as 40 years before the plant is able to be considered decommissioned.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Tuesday, April 30th, 2013. A Palestinian man killed by an Israeli army air raid targeting the Gaza Strip and armed settler killed in the West Bank. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A Palestinian man was assassinated by an Israeli missile northwest of Gaza City on Tuesday morning. Two Palestinians have been injured in the attack. Local sources said that an army unmanned plane fired one missile at a motorcycle driven by Haytham Mishal, 29, leading to his instant death, while two residents were injured and were moved to Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza. Mishal is from Ash-Shati' refugee camp. He worked as a guard at Al-Shifa Medical Center. Both of his legs were severed due to the blast. He also suffered various injuries that led to his death. The attack was carried out shortly before a number of armored military vehicles invaded a Shuja'iyah neighborhood east of Gaza City. In other news, Israeli sources reported on Tuesday that an Israeli settler of the Yitzhar illegal settlement near the northern West Bank city of Nablus was stabbed to death by a Palestinian man near the Za'atara roadblock. According